Good morning, everyone. You'll see upstairs near the albums, there's the latest issue of our twice-yearly journal, Invocation, Study Notes on Savitri. And in it, there's an appeal, which I hope you will not just screw up and throw into the waste paper basket, but have a look at. This issue of Invocation contains the transcript of Sonia Dine's talk in February on the world stare, and the latest installment of The English of Savitri, which covers Book 2, Canto 4, the last two sections, Sections 5 and 6. So in our reading, we have moved on. The beautiful music we just listened to is from Book 2, Canto 9, The Paradise of the Life Gods. That is the last of the life worlds which Sri Aurobindo describes for us. King Aswapati moves on towards the worlds of mind. And in Canto 10, Kingdoms and Godheads of the Little Mind, which begins on page 238, we have read the first section, that is, up to page 243 at the break. So I think it will be nice to go back to the beginning of the canto and have a closer look at this first section before we move on further. Shall we start at the top today? Lela, would you start? Page 238.
The kingdoms and the paths of the little mind. This too must now be overpassed and left, as all must be until the highest is gained, in whom the world themselves grow true and one. Till that is reached, our journey cannot cease. Always an endless goal beckons beyond. Always ascends the zigzag of the gods, and upward points the spirit's climbing fire. This breath of hundred new felicity, and this pure heightened figure of time's joy, tossed upon waves of flawless happiness, hammered into single beads of ecstasy, distraction of the spirit's interior, caught into a passionate greatness of its dreams. This limited being lifted to zenith bliss, happy to enjoy one touch of things supreme, packed into its sealed small infinity, its endless time-made world of facing time, a little foot of God's vast delight.
Thank you. So the previous canto, The Paradise of the Life Gods, expressed a world of immortal pleasure, supreme delight, immortality, the rapture that the gods sustain. Now Canto 10 begins by saying that even this paradise, this too must now be overpassed and left, as he has passed over and left so many other levels of the world's stair. And Sri Aurobindo says everything must be overpassed and left until the soul gains the highest, that highest level in whom the world and self grow true and one. Till that is reached, our journeying cannot cease. And when he says our, I think he means our souls. Our journeying cannot cease. So for Aswapati, always this nameless goal. He doesn't know the name of that goal that he is aiming at, but it's beckoning, calling to him. And this zigzag path of the cosmic powers and levels is always going higher and higher, and upward points the spirit's climbing fire, that fire of aspiration which is leading the soul.
Why would you say it's a zigzag instead of a straight ascent?
He says it. You ask him. I think when you're climbing a mountain, just to go straight from the bottom to the top is rather difficult. So we go this way, and then we go that way, and this way, and that way. Of course, you know there is this little sketch of the mother that she has made to illustrate the path of yoga to a child. She shows the square at the bottom, the manifestation that we start from, and at the top there's a a sphere, which is our goal, and she says it can be reached directly. Yeah. She drew a straight line, but mostly because of our human nature, the way we are made, the way this cosmos is made, the path is a zigzag one. But if we realize that there is a straight path and we can follow it, that can speed things up a lot. So as for... Sorry? I think it means the cosmic powers that are ruling the universe. Yeah. Yes, I don't know the answer to that question.
Mm-hmm. I'll support those who are following this yoga, but it is too difficult. Maybe for him, he prefers zigzag.
Yeah, I think very few have found that absolutely direct way.
Mm-hmm. And that sketch has been the inspiration for the progress gathering.
Yes.
Progress gathering. It's a square where there's a pond with lotus on the side of the viewing point.
And there's a straight path, but it goes up and down a bit, doesn't it? Yeah, that drawing.
This week someone showed me the story of the mother called The Virtues.
Yes.
And I had read it before, but this time, for the first time I noticed, she refers to the virtues as gods and goddesses.
Divine powers, yeah.
And then when gratitude comes, they don't recognize her.
Yes.
But I think gratitude is what takes you straight to the goal, by the sunlit path, if you can be grateful.
Yes.
And the key is, I found, is that you have to be grateful when times are hard. That's right. Hard part. We're grateful when something seems good for us, but otherwise...
Yes, I think her advice to Maggie Lychee was try to be grateful for everything.
That's a real challenge.
Yeah. Well, that is a good way to make some progress. So then he returns, he says this again. The first word of the canto is this, referring to the world of the previous canto. And now again he says this, and he means the same thing, this paradise of the life gods. And he describes it as a breath of hundred-hued felicity. So many different kinds of delight.
What is felicity?
Felicity is another word for happiness, intense happiness. Often he seems to use it here almost for bliss.
Almost?
For bliss. So it's fortunate that there are several words in English for happiness. Felicity is one of them. So he says this paradise is a breath of hundred-hued felicity, all many different colors. And its pure, heightened figure of time's joy, the kind of delight that can be enjoyed in this universe of time and space and individualization. That world expresses a figure, a representation, a pure figure, a heightened figure, intensified figure of the joys that can be experienced in time. And it seems almost to be on a sea, tossed upon waves of flawless happiness, happiness that is not spoiled by the slightest imperfection or shadow. He says that world is hammered into single beats of ecstasy. It's as if the heartbeats are hammering away to create this intense delight of ecstasy. But then he says, this fraction of the spirit's integral. It's only a tiny portion of the whole bliss of the spirit, no? But it has been caught up into a passionate greatness of extremes, extremes of different kinds of delight. Then he says, this limited being, the spirit of that world is still a limited being, but it's been lifted up to the summit, the very highest point of bliss. It's happy just to enjoy one touch of things supreme. And into the small infinity of this world, which is sealed up, cut off from all the other worlds, it packs into that sealed small infinity, its endless time-made world, which is out-facing time. It's looking at time and saying, you are not the only thing. There's something else. If you outface somebody, you stand up to them and don't let them overwhelm you. So the bliss of this world is outfacing time. It gives a little output of God's vast delight. So in just a few lines, he's very firmly put this world and its status into its place in the cosmic whole. Doris, would you go on?
The moments stretch towards eternal now. The hours discover immortality, but satisfied with their supreme content. On these they cease who stops halfway to heaven. After having pointed to an apex they could never know, to a grandeur in whose air they could not live, inviting to their height and exquisite sphere, to their secure and fine extremities, this creature who hugs to his limit to feel safe. These heights decline to greater adventures call. A glory and sweetness of satisfied desire tied up the spirit to golden thoughts and lips. It could not house the wildness of the soul which needed all infinity for its needs.
Thank you. Anybody would like to ask anything? Which line are you looking at?
26.
That's, I think, the hours, perhaps, here.
21 to 22, on peace they cease.
Yes. I think it's the hours that is the subject of that sentence, or the moments. The moments and the hours. The moments stretch towards the eternal now. The hours discovered immortality. But they are satisfied with their sublime contents. So they cease. They cease on peaks, on very high levels, but those tops only reach halfway to heaven. Those peaks point to an apex, to a highest point that they can't reach, to a grandeur in whose air they could not live.
We're saying the time is time in an hour.
No, I mean the hours and the moment, that world, are absolutely delightful, but they are satisfied. They are not pointing any, I mean they're pointing up to something, but they are not reaching for something. They point to an apex they could never mount and to a grandeur in whose air they could not live. That's on even higher levels, no? And what they do, they're very inviting for us. They invite this creature, us, we creatures who hug our limits to feel safe. They invite us to that high and exquisite sphere. When we read about it, there's something in us which finds it so appealing, that high and exquisite sphere, to their secure and fine extremities. It reminds us a bit of the world of subtle matter, which has limits, but very beautiful limits. They are safe, and we need limits to feel safe. The limitless is a bit terrifying. So these heights of this paradise decline, refused the call of a greater adventure. Their glory and sweetness of satisfied desire tied up the spirit, ties it up to golden posts of bliss. So it doesn't go any further. That world could not house the wideness of a soul which needed all infinity for its home. It cannot satisfy Asvapati. Inevitably, he's attracted further on. Chitra, would you read?
For memory, soft as glass and faint as sleep, the beauty and fall receiving sand behind, like a sweet song heard fade far away upon the long high road to timelessness. met a silver gray expanse where day and night had wedded and were one. It was a tract of dim and shifting rays, parting life's sentient flow from thought's self-poise. A coalition of uncertainties, there exercised uneasy government on a ground reserved for doubt and reason guess, a rendezvous of knowledge with ignorance.
Thank you. It's as if he's floating away, no? And as he floats, there's a memory soft as grass and faint as sleep of that world. That beauty, its attraction is getting fainter and fainter as he moves, like a sweet song heard fading far away as he moves further upon the long, high road to timelessness. He's passed through that beautiful realm. Now he's moving on further. And he sees above him an ardent white tranquility, intense, that tranquility, and white, pure and integral.
He likes to put kind of opposite words.
Yes, when he brings them together, yes. A musing spirit. One dreaming almost, looked out on the worlds from that ardent white tranquility. And Asvapati sees something like a series of skies climbing higher and higher, passing through clarity to a light which can't be seen. We know the light is there because it's lighting up these skies. These skies are large, lucent realms of mind shining from that stillness above. That's what he's moving on to now. But as he moves along this long high road to timelessness, before reaching those ardent white tranquilities, first he met a silver gray expanse where day and night had wedded and were one, a twilight world. Silver grey. It's not very dark, but still it's a kind of twilight where day and night mingle. That silver grey expanse was a tract, an area of dim and shifting rays, which were parting the sentient flow of life from the self-poise of thought. This is a transitional area, a borderland, where life is one level, thought is another. In between, there's this kind of silver-gray twilight. And there, in that tract of dim and shifting rays, there's a coalition ruling. Coalition is when you have different parties who have different views and different plans joined together, just out of expediency, because it's useful. That coalition of uncertainties, exercise, uneasy government. Coalitions are always a bit uneasy, you know, because the parties can't agree. And what they are governing over is a ground, an area, which is actually reserved, set aside for doubts and reasoned guess, a place where knowledge and ignorance meet together, a rendezvous. It's a place where you meet, no? Reserved, yes. Srinivas.
I think slow
extremity
can be the biggest way. The mind that hardly stops, that's the slowly form. Nature flows, earthly nature flows, and keep your precarious mortal form that looks from soil to sky and sky to soil, but knows not the below, nor the beyond. It only sends itself on outward things. This was the first means of our slow ascent from the half conscience of the animal soul, living in a crowded press of shaped events. In a realm, it cannot understand nor change. Only it sees and acts in a given scene, and feels and drives and sorrows for a while. The ideas that drive the obscure embodied soul along the roads of suffering and desire, in a world that struggles to discover truth, found here their power, deep and nature falls. Here are devices upon forms of an ignorant life, but sees the entire fact as settled love, labors for the hour and not for eternity, and creates schemes to meet the moments for the slow process of the material mind. It serves the body, it should rule and use, and needs to lean upon an erring sense, was born in the illusionist obscurity.
Thank you. In a way, this passage which Srinivas has just read takes us back to the end of Canto 4, Kingdoms of the Little Life. The last two sections of that canto describe the beginning of the emergence of mind from involved life, from the sense impressions which are native to life, beginning to emerge something that we would recognize as intelligence. But Shobindo doesn't continue that sequence in the next canto. He moves instead inwards into the subtle worlds, the godheads of the little life, and then there's the greater life and so on. Other realms of life are explored. But now we've reached the final, and there's the terrible descent, which we have seen, into the night and the world of falsehood, and the discovery of the key of nature's change, which projects Asvapati up into this paradise of the life gods. But now he's leaving that behind, and he's entered this realm which stands between the worlds of life and the different levels of mind. And he says that at the lowest level, at the lowest extremity, there's a mind ruling with difficulty, a mind that held difficult sway. Sway means rule. There's a mind that hardly saw and slowly found. The nature of that mind is close to our earthly nature. It's kin, it's closely related to our precarious mortal thought that looks from soil to sky and sky to soil, but doesn't know what lies below the soil or beyond the sky. This mind can only sense itself and outward things. That's like our mind. This was the first means of our slow ascent, the way that we have evolved from the half-conscience of the animal soul, living in a crowded press of shape events in a realm it cannot understand nor change. If you live with animals, it's very interesting to see how they think somehow, or how their minds work. They experience a lot. There's a crowded press of sense and shape events, but it can't understand where it is, and it has no control. That's why animals are often so dissatisfied. I have a little cat, and she's so dissatisfied. No. She needs somebody to open the door for her and to feed her, and she has no control over her world. No. And she's very upset about that. Of course, she's aspiring for something better, and I hope she gets it in her next incarnation. No. Only that animal mind, animal soul, sees and acts in a given scene, and it feels and joys and sorrows for a while. There are ideas formed on a very high level of the creation. Those ideas are driving forward the whole process of evolution. They're driving the obscure, embodied spirit along the roads of suffering and desire in this world that's struggling to discover truth. So those ideas here in this, or there in this world of where knowledge and ignorance meet, they're here they found their power to be and their nature force. Here on this level, between life and mind, are devised forms of an ignorant life which sees the empiric fact, the way things are, as settled law. It labors for the hour, it wants immediate results, not for eternity. And so it's ready to trade its gains just to meet the moment's call, the satisfaction of the moment. The slow process of a material mind based on a physical brain, which serves the body, it should rule and use. The mind is meant to be the master of the body, but that material mind needs to lean upon the senses. And the senses are not reliable. The information they give us is erring. They make mistakes, and we make mistakes in interpreting them. He says that material mind was born in that luminous obscurity, that silver-gray expanse. Of course, now we are in the kingdoms and godheads of the mind, and this is the lowest level that he's describing here. He will take us further before the end of the canto. But now he goes on describing that material mind a bit further. Do you like to read?
Advancing on the Olympic star, crushing hypothesis on argument, groaning its theories as certainties, reasons from the half known to the unknown, frail house of thought, ever undoing the web that it has spun. The twilight sage, whose shadow seems to himself moving from minute to breathe.
Thank you. Anybody would like to ask or share anything about this interesting passage?
Could you explain, well, I think you're going to explain everything for me, but could you explain the sentence 81, twilight sage, whose shadow seems to himself?
So already Sri Aurobindo's told us that this level is a kind of twilight, no? Silver-gray expanse. And in this twilight, the mind seems to be relatively, to give a light, a sage, that to express some kind of wisdom. No? But this sage identifies himself. He thinks that he is what is actually only his shadow. Does that make sense to you? Satellites, where are the satellites? Oh, a king dependent on his satellites. So, yes, satellites, they circle around a planet. No? So the mind is meant to be the king, the ruler. But at this level, he can't do anything except without the help of these satellite moons and rocks that are circling around him. He's dependent on them. So he just says yes to whatever they propose, signs the decrees of ignorant ministers. He doesn't really know what he's doing. Yes, Don?
Right where we are now, a twilight sage whose shadow seems to himself moving from, and then I'm confused with minute or minute.
It's minute. Minute. He moves from minute to minute, and every minute is brief. No, it's not. No, these are both minutes. Brief minute. He lives, not brief minute lives, lives. He lives moving from minute to brief minute. How can we distinguish? And how can we distinguish between lives and lives? Difficult. The English language poses us conundrums. Sorry. Moving from minute to brief minute lives. Got it? Yeah. Thank you. A clamant. This is clamant. It means he makes a lot of noise. Clamor. A clamorous voice. He shouts out all his postulates, his theories, but they are all uncertain. But still, we defend them like mad, you know, the things we believe in. They are just postulates. So this mind is powerful. but he's bound by his instruments, the things that are his tools, what he needs to help him. And he's also quite proud of himself. He thinks that he is the highest level of nature, the mental being. Yeah, we are men, we are the we are the top. We are unaware of our share in all the rest of the creation, in all things made. And we, in a way, we are very humble. We think that we are just produce of earth, of mud, you know, that we've just evolved up from matter. But we are also haughty. It's again these opposites going together. He's haughtily humble. He believes himself a spawn of matter's mud and takes his own creations for his cause. In fact, all these things are products of mind, but we see it the other way around, that everything is products of consciousness. We think of it all as products of matter.
What is haughtily?
Haughtily, when you're very proud of yourself. Yeah, well, that's again. You think you're the top of creation, but at the same time you think you're a product of matter, of mud. So it's a kind of paradox, contradiction.
Doesn't haughty also imply a false belief? You're haughty about yourself being
here. Yes, you're self-aggrandizement. Yeah. But then these last lines of this little paragraph are so inspiring, no? And from time to time, Sri Aurobindo tells us this, that up from man's bare beginning is our climb. Out of earth's heavy smallness we must break. We must search our nature with spiritual fire. An insect crawl, as if we are caterpillars, no? Preludes our glorious flight. Our human state cradles the future God. Our mortal frailty, our subjection to death and ignorance is containing within it the potentiality of an immortal force. So there are so many places in the poem when he says, when are you going to wake up and realize your potential? How long are you going to go round and round and round like this? Earth needs you to wake up and take on your true role. But now he moves on to another realm. Lorraine.
Our mortal frailty and immortal force at the glow-worm top of the
breathe.
In life's moving act, a covert nurse of nature's miracles. It shaped life's wonders out of the matter's mind. It cut the pattern of the shapes of things. It pitched mind's tent in the vague, ignorant vast. A master magician of measure and device has made an eternity of reoccurring forms. And to wandering spectator thought, assigned a seat of inconscient state.
Let's pause there. So that was the lowest extremity we were reading about, no? And of course there's a gradation, there's always a gradation. So the top of that lowest level is a glowworm top. Glowworms are those little worms that can, they have their own bioluminescence. Sometimes there are so many of them, you can collect them and keep them in a glass jar and read by that light, no? It can be done. So these pale glimmer realms, this silver-gray expanse, there's a borderline where the light of dawn, the shine, the dawn sheen, plays with that native dusk of the lower level. And that play of dawn and dusk helps the day of full consciousness, to grow, and the night to fail and sink away. So at that level, at that borderline, Asvapati escapes over a wide and shimmering bridge, and he comes into a realm of early light of the first light of morning. And there's the regency of a half-risen sun. A regency is when, for some reason, the real ruler can't rule and somebody else is replacing him. A half-risen sun. It makes us think, or it makes me think, about the significance of Savitri's name. We have so many different names for the sun in India, but the Savitri sun is the sun which has not yet risen above the horizon. So this one is a bit more, it's a bit further up. There's a half-risen sun. Dawn is definitely approaching, a greater light. And out of the rays of that rising sun, that half-risen sun, the full orb of our mind, our human mind, is born. And then he describes this.
Did you say Savitri is the
sun before it has risen above the horizon? Yeah. So it always, Savitri represents the new light, is coming. It's on its way, we can see it's on its way, but it hasn't come.
You finished this in 15 before the supermind had manifested.
Savitri is the sun.
Savitri is a name for the sun, yes.
Savitam, the root would be Savitra. The original form of the word would be Savitra, but the son would be called Savita. Savitri, the word would mean daughter of. That would be the Sanskrit.
Thank you, Anmol.
Yeah.
Like Matra, the word Mata for mother. Mata is the feminine form, but the original root sound, Pratipadik, what it is called, that's Matra. Similarly, Pitra becomes Pita. So it's Savitra, which becomes Savita and Savitra.
Like Matr becomes Matrimandir.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah? Temple of the mother. Thank you.
Does it mean Savitri incarnated word?
Sorry?
Savitri, does that mean incarnated word?
Yes, there's two significances to this name. One refers to her being the daughter of the sun. The other significance, they must be related, refers to her being the Shakti, the wife of Brahma. So that means she's the supreme creative force, the word of command, the incarnate word of command. So both those suggestions are there in this name.
She's not the full supermental glory, because you can't express the supermind in words. Shrivino refers to Savitri as over mental poetry.
Hey, let's not go into all that, Patty. But what he does is he refers to her in the poem as the supreme divine mother of the truth light. Oh, wisdom, splendor, mother of the universe. Oh, truth. Yeah, so it's a beautiful passage. And it's very interesting. It's one of the passages he composed in 1916. There are a few passages that haven't changed since the very first version that we know. And there's this sentence here in book three. I would like to find it, if you'd be patient with me.
You remember where that passage is, where he says, oh, wisdom
splendor? Yeah, I'm just looking for it. Page 345. Thank you, Amol. You're so helpful this morning. 45. Yeah. Oh, truth, defended in thy secret sun, voice of her mighty musings in shut heavens, on things withdrawn within her luminous depth. O wisdom splendor, mother of the universe, creatrix, the eternal's artist bride.
What page is that?
Page 345, near the top. And that is the power that King Asvapati has been worshipping for 18 years in order to gain the boon of a tribe of princes who will transform the earth, no? And finally here, after page 345, the goddess grants him the boon. But in the traditional story, she says, Lord Brahma has said, so it's the Supreme Lord who says, that you will not have 100 sons that you want. You will have one daughter, but that one daughter will be worth 100 sons. So be happy. Be content. Accept.
Here he's addressing the Supreme Mother. Yeah. So then she agrees to send
an emanation of herself. He says, mission to earth, some form of thee. And she agrees. She says, yes, one shall descend and change the iron law.
Why this line, which was defended in thy secret son, why it is defended?
Yes, I think it's like a French défendu, means you're protected. We can't reach you. You're beyond our reach, something like that. I mean, that's how I understand. So let's have a look at this prototypal deft intelligence that's been appointed by the spirit of the worlds to mediate with the unknowing depths, with the depths of unconsciousness. It's like a kind of bird, a hovering bird, half poised on equal wings of thought and doubt, and it's toiling ceaselessly, flying up and down between the hidden ends of being, the highest end and the lowest end. So because of the presence of that intelligence, a secrecy breathes in life's moving acts. It's no longer just life. Some new intelligence has entered, no? A covert nurse of nature's miracles. Secretly, that secrecy is acting covertly. But what she's doing is bringing about the miracles of nature. It's this intelligence that shapes life's wonders out of matter's mud. It's this intelligence that cut the pattern of the shapes of things. It pitched mind's tent in the vague, ignorant vast. He's moving around this mind, and here he has his little tent, which is his base. Mm-hmm. I think that's where we stopped, no? Shall we?
The way this reminds us that mind did not come out of the mud.
Right. Mind has come from above, yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But so did life.
Yeah.
Yes, we read about it, how life has come from above also. So it's only because these powers exist in a free form on the higher levels that they could descend into matter and then emerge again from matter, creating of this union. Yes, Don?
It may be irrelevant to what we're doing, but just lately there's been a series of articles I've read about the extraordinary intelligence of the raven. So man is not the only receiver of mind.
No.
It means from
And we can think with the knowledge that has been given to us that now supermind is at work in nature, that animals are increasing in intelligence and sensitivity. There are really remarkable stories that happen. No. A raven, it's a big black bird that lives.
And it's bigger and very black.
It lives in the...
Crows
live in cities, but ravens live in the mountains.
Mm.
And they can learn to speak. Sometimes they speak, tame ravens. Yeah.
And trees and plants also independent.
Sorry?
Trees and plants also are much more conscious. And you can get a lot of things of the intelligence of the relation.
We are at least becoming more conscious of their intelligence. But perhaps they are also becoming more intelligent. Perhaps we stop there for today.
Thanks to Sri Aurobindo.